It is 4:38. You've got Downtown on a Wednesday afternoon presented by Hollywood Casino. 500 Main Street in downtown Bangor. Rich Kimble, Brian Stackpole, and Bruce Pratt with us for Sports Lit 101. And joining us as a special guest, we talked about her book last week, and she joins us today. Sue Eisenfeld is the author of Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal. Sue, thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a very interesting book and fascinating on so many levels. And then when you add to it the talk about a potential national park in Maine, it certainly adds another level of interest. We'll talk about any connections that might be there. But let's lead off with the fact that you didn't set out to find scandal and stories that shocked you about Shenandoah National Park. And like so many of us, you simply for many years enjoyed the park and that area, the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains, without knowing some of the history.
That's right. I did. I was just a hiker like the park planners envisioned. I was a busy professional from Washington, D.C., and went out there for recreation and enjoyment. But I couldn't help but notice over the years that there were signs of human habitation in the woods.
Yeah, Sue, this is Bruce Pratt. A question, you know, when you think about national parks, I think it's so sort of comes in the opposite direction of so much of American history. They sort of move west to east, that Yosemite and Yellowstone and those places predate Shenandoah, Smoky Mountain, Acadia. Can you give us a little history of why the people want the forces of the Commonwealth wanted to create this park where it is?
Yeah, well, before I even get to Virginia, the federal government wanted to create a park in the east because they wanted a national park that people could get to more easily, and all the parks out west were pretty far away. So in the age of the automobile, they wanted people to be able to drive. And so there were many towns and cities and states that wanted a national park created. Virginia just happened to win out on this particular contest and that particular time. And the state of Virginia and the local area wanted the park to come there for economic development, to preserve the beauty of the place, to preserve the southern Appalachian forest, and because Virginia had a mission that they were going to develop the state by preserving history and beauty rather than developing industry.
Yeah, and that's one of the nexuses with what's going on here. But I wanted to ask you if you could explain a little bit about when push came to shove, the kinds of ways in which the people who lived there who did not want to leave, the ones who wanted to stay, were portrayed. I'm thinking about books like Hollow Folk and the like. If you could just, because that isn't going on here, and I think that's a part of history that a lot of us don't really know about.
Yeah, well, I would say that the Commonwealth of Virginia and the federal government would tell you that they weren't involved in any kind of movement to portray the people any which way. But I think that because of the times were different, they did wind up portraying the people as uneducated, stupid hillbillies who would be better off being moved somewhere else. And I think those who are cynical do believe that those types of statements were used as a way to build support for moving them when it became clear that they'd have to move, and so that nobody would feel bad about it. Like, they'll be better off getting moved in the lowlands instead of living this hardscrabble, godforsaken existence in the mountains.
And as you pointed out, there was really no organized resistance to this park. It was something that the people in Virginia could see the value of. Certainly keeping something that close to Washington, D.C. out of the hands of every developer has been a great boon to us all. Was there any sense that if this were more modern times, it would be a lot more difficult, sure, to acquire that land?
I think it would, because, you know, of course, now we have the Internet and all kinds of ways of connecting with one another, which they didn't have back then. Even the communities throughout the 100-mile distance of Shenandoah National Park, they really were very separate from one another, separated by hollows and ridges, and they could not really come together and form any collective resistance. There were other forces, too. The times were different then. They weren't involved in so many ways. I think today, the people being affected by such a park would definitely be involved, and I would assume that there would definitely be more protest altogether.
Another thing I think is pretty interesting about this part of history, which I didn't really have a good grip on when I read the book, and it's and just for our listeners, this is a very well written book. You will really enjoy reading it. Is the way that that the other parks out west were not anywhere near population centers. I mean, of any size, as is the case used to be the case with Acadia until. You know, New England got bigger and like when you look at all the other major East Coast cities other than Washington, D.C., and you see what is not near them, they don't have a national park. Do you think in the long run this is really one of the great things the federal government did for conservation?
I think Shenandoah is a great park. And, of course, I've spent more than 20 years going there. So I guess if you're asking me if I think this particular park is a great one, yes, I do. I think, you know, at the time that they opened the park in 1936, it was within a day's drive of a third of the population of the United States, and millions of people have been going there every year. So I don't think we can say it was a bad decision. I think that things could have been done better that would make it less sad for the people who were removed.
Right, and go ahead, Rich.
No, we're talking with Sue Eisenfeld, author of Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal. Sue, I wanted to ask you, too, the descendants of those people who were displaced years later now, do they go to the park? Do they still feel a family connection to that land?
Some of them go to the park, and some of them do not want to go to the park. All of the ones I've spoken to feel very much connection to that land and feel very strongly about what happened. Some people are still as upset about it today as if it happened yesterday. Other people have kind of gotten over it. A lot of people have told me that they can see the benefit of it, that they know that this way rich people will not be able to build McMansions on the top of the mountain, and that everybody can go and enjoy it, including them. So I think you have some acceptance and understanding among the descendants, but you still have a lot of sadness and anger about what happened as well.
And you could tell us, our listeners, a little bit about the way that the old cemeteries of these families are open to them, in some cases, to still use and to maintain. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, there are about 100 cemeteries in Shenandoah. Many of them are inaccessible, but if they are accessible, people can go to them. My understanding is that the families always have the right to bury people in the cemeteries, but the problem is some of them are in wilderness areas, and you can't bring cars and roads into wilderness areas, so inevitably some of them are abandoned. But there are still some that are active, and burials still take place there, so it just depends on where your family cemetery happened to be and whether wilderness designation was in that area.
Could you tell us a little bit about, I'm going to ask you to take a guess at something here. I mean, one of the things that's going on here in Maine is that the land for the proposed national park is already in private hands, and it's land that this person wishes to donate. I'm sitting here being somewhat cynical, saying, well, that really doesn't matter, does it, unless the government wants another national park? I've done a lot of research on this. Can you imagine that would be something that the government would be jumping out of their skin to create that close to Acadia?
My sense is that the national park designation, as opposed to national monument, national historic park, and other designations that are part of the National Park Service, the national park designation is reserved for very few places that are the most beautiful, most important gems of our nation. So without being able to speak on behalf of the National Park Service, I really can't say, but my opinion is that this would not necessarily be an area that they would designate as a national park. However, they might be interested in it for designation at some other level.
Right. That's one of the things that the person wishes to donate the property doesn't want to do is anything other than that. I suppose the reason I asked that is, you know, we've had in Maine, we have a fund for Maine land that gets tied up in politics, that sort of get tied around the country. Do you see a growing support for these parks among the population, or do you see people beginning to just look at the dollars?
When you say look at the dollars, do you you mean for economic benefits?
Well, no, I meant more for the cost of maintaining the parks. I mean, we know that Acadia didn't have a full season a couple of years ago because the government didn't appropriate as much money. I mean, in any way, do you worry that the parks that we have are under any kind of threat from a lack of funding or disinterest?
I think that a lot of agencies in the federal government are underfunded, and the Park Service is one of them. So that's a problem all the way around. What I can tell you is that I know, for example, with Shenandoah, in the last report of economic development, there was $73 million in local economic benefit from people going to that park, which says to me that lots of people are still using that park.
I'm going there soon myself on a trip to somewhere else, and it's a place Rich and I certainly know. Is that just also D.C., or is that the whole country's visiting it?
That particular number was for Shenandoah alone, but what I have also read is that there's $13 billion spent, I believe is the number, in all the national parks nationwide. So, I mean, what that tells me is that people are still going. You know, it's a pretty cheap vacation to go to a national park. The entry fee is pretty minimal compared to, you know, some other places like Disney World. And I think that people still enjoy our national parks as much as they ever did. I think the idea that a park could be taken away for lack of use is not something that people think about or that has ever been discussed, to my knowledge.
Well, it's a fascinating read. Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal. Sue Eisenfeld, a wonderful book. Thank you so much for visiting with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
It's about 10 minutes to go before the top of the hour here.